Well, welcome everybody to the first episode of this podcast in quite a long time. Actually, the last time we recorded anything in this series was about 3 years ago. But given the work I've done in the past related to Marvel, both the comics and the MCU, and given my guests' work as well, this just seemed like the perfect opportunity to do our little take on a look back at 10 years of Marvel films and bask in the glow of the Infinity Gauntlet for a little while. So I wanted to welcome Scott Calora. Scott, thank you so much again for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me. I was so glad when you suggested this. I never tire of talking about the MCU.
I mainly thought this would be a chance for us to just sit and talk for a little bit. I can't think of anybody else I'd rather talk about the movie with. And we've done this before. I mean, now what is you've done a few in the past. Like more recently, you came on Doctor the Dead. We talked about the Omega Man.
Yep.
And we did a G to V a long time ago about all the Planet of the Apes movies. But I think, was it the first thing, I think, was you did the first one of these with me when we were going to start the Marvel stuff.
Yeah, I think so. So
that's a while ago already. But anyway, yeah. Let's just jump right into it. I mean, one thing I'll say flat out is I don't expect anyone listening shouldn't expect us to cover everything. This is a wide-ranging topic, and I took some notes. I've only seen it once, which is a little odd, but I was planning to go watch it again at least one more time this week. But I did actually see it on opening day, April 27th, which I did not necessarily anticipate doing. And as a film that culminates, or rather brings together 10 years of continuity in all these characters, let's just jump right in with the basic question, which is what we thought of it and whether it accomplished what it set out to do. And we'll start with you.
Yeah. I mean, I think it did. You go into it and you wonder, are they really going to be able to pull this off with this many characters and sort of setting up these expectations for years now about this big Infinity War thing that, you know, seems like Thanos has been coming for so long now. You know, it almost sort of became a running joke at a certain point. But I think they really, by and large, did pull it off. I think it came down to what the MCU ultimately does best is that it is about these characters in the end. And I thought that the emotional through line for so many of the characters was just terrific and strong and, you know, fairly tragic at times as well. But I think, you know, that's the reason why the MCU has been going strong now for 10 years, which is crazy. And I think that's why Infinity War works as well, is because of those characters still. What about you?
I have to agree. I mean, there are a lot of things I'll probably throw out as we go along that are certainly criticisms of aspects of it, and we can pick at bits and pieces. But I can't say that anything that I think about it in any negative way to me impacts the overall amazing accomplishment of this film. I mean, you take, like we're going to keep repeating, I'm sure, whatever, you take 10 years of character development and story, and you say, yeah, but now we're going to do a, well, two-part movie, actually, that knits all this together, pays off lots of little bits and pieces, juggles all of these characters and locations, and does it in a way that doesn't feel like you're getting whiplash.
Right.
And it was frankly amazing at times how well-crafted I felt all of it was. And one of the only major, like, overall things I would say is I can't honestly say I enjoyed this movie nearly as much as I enjoy many of the other, particularly standalone films in the past. But that's because this is a different experience, and it touches on one of the main topics I wanted us to talk about, which is there's a lot of debate out there about this kind of storytelling in film at all. And I've had plenty of conversations where people are like, yeah, but this movie doesn't stand on its own, or it doesn't tell a story. And I can't necessarily argue that isn't true, but my point would be this film functions differently than another film where you sit down and intend to see a beginning, middle, and end. This is more like seeing a chapter in a long-running television show.
Right, yeah. And the line is sort of blurred between what counts as a sort of standalone story and what doesn't these days anyway, because the you know mainstream crowd has become so enamored of these things. It's not just comic book fans anymore. I mean, the reason these things are going strong is because regular people are into them, and they, by and large, are fine with the idea of this sort of serialized story that started in 2008 with Iron Man, and mm-hmm. it's obviously become increasingly serialized as we've gone along. And I think the crowd, the audience, kind of knows that, you know, certain ones we're going to get, like Black Panther is fairly standalone, you know, there's mm-hmm. a few things here or there, but it's mainly its own movie. And then, okay, now we're going to do an Avengers where every, you know, everything kind of converges. And I understand that some people might object to that, but I don't see what harm it's doing. It's just a different type of movie, as you say. And you know what? If it's not your cup of tea, you don't have to go see it either, right? So it's just, you know, it's just a piece of the puzzle, but that doesn't affect your, that doesn't mean you can't still enjoy a Black Panther on its own. And if you're not into these more serialized Avengers team-up type movies, then you just can avoid those and go see the ones that are standalone more.
Yeah, and I mean, in the future, I mean, they're going to put almost everybody back anyway, so...
Right,
you know, yeah. So, I mean, like, when Spider-Man 2 rolls around, or, you know, you're going to see Ant-Man and the Wasp, you know, yeah. you can either care about the connectivity or not. You probably would pick up on whatever the status quo of the universe is at that point with just a few little bits and pieces you might have to look up apart from the film you're seeing. But,
yeah.
No, it's not necessary, and... And overall, stepping back, I know that, well, both of us are certainly very biased emotionally about these things.
Sure.
But I still felt that I could see a lot of issues with it in certain specifics. But just getting back to that first main point, it's an extraordinary thing to be able to throw all these people into this movie, travel to, what, at least a half a dozen places we go to, at different mm-hmm. points, and then on top of it, and by the way, that's another thing, is that this is full spoilers through this whole thing we're doing, and then end with what I definitely feel is one of the darkest and most depressing and horrifying endings I've ever seen in a mainstream action film.
Yeah,
and crazy. And I gotta tell you, like, here's actually, now that I think of it, and you and I have spent time talking about Beneath the Planet of the Apes. I mean, granted, there wasn't blood spraying everywhere, but this felt pretty close to that same kind of thing, don't you think?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, Peter, I think Peter Parker's last words are he apologizes to Tony Stark for ceasing to exist, you know.
Yeah, like, the begging I don't want to go thing is the part that really makes it painful.
Yeah, and it's not just that everyone is wiped out in this nihilistic sort of moment, but it's the way it's done is very sort of poetic and magical in a way. It's mm-hmm. it really, you know, the choice to have them sort of turn to dust the way they do, and I believe in the comic people just blinked out of existence. And and it's just, you know, even if you look, I've watched the film twice now, and each person's sort of disappearance, they're all shot from different sort of perspectives and angles. It's just really kind of amazing and beautiful, despite what is being depicted. You know, the horror of it, it still looks so sort of grand, and then that's it, and then it's over, and it's weirdly a happy ending for Thanos, which even makes it even more complicated when you think about it.
Yeah, it's really a weird feeling at the end to see him happy, and then go to black with the credits, and yeah, I agree with you. It's just like gorgeous effects work. I mean, this entire movie is just wall to wall effects on every conceivable level, and that in particular. That has to carry so much emotional weight, and they did a beautiful job with that. It was pointed out to me also at one point how, and I can only justify this as it must be like a wave coming from wherever Thanos first does it, is that
right.
It's interesting that it takes time.
Yeah.
Like half the people don't vanish in a heartbeat, or else you wouldn't have Nick Fury having time to contact Captain Marvel.
Right.
So there's like a wave happening, you know?
And yeah.
I figure, well, it's probably, and the thing is, since they look like they're actually being carried on the wind, maybe that's part of the effect. It's like there's this wave expanding and just blowing them all away.
Yeah, that's terrific. Yeah, that's but great.
I have to say, though, I worry about this to the extent that I don't really think this movie is good for some of the younger fans. At least not without waiting for the next one so you can show it to them both at the same time.
Right.
Because we went to see it, and there was actually a birthday party in the theater, which I thought was wonderful at the time, because I thought, this is great. It was a nicely packed crowd. We went on the afternoon of opening day, and there were a bunch of little kids there. It was mostly boys. I don't know the age, like maybe 9, 10, something like that. And, yeah. And they were like all in the front rows, and they were having food, and they were having a great time. But boy, you know, about 10, 15 minutes before the end of it, the crying started. And not just kids either. There were grown people behind me. And the thing is, I've cried at plenty of these when I've been moved by something. But yeah. I do have to say, strangely, I never felt too emotionally moved by this one. I think I just felt it was just too obvious that most of this will be undone.
Right.
So, yeah. But the kids were tortured. And one of the kids' his father was saying, he's like, don't worry, they'll be back. And I actually saw a tweet that same day that some father had sent saying that he had taken his son to see it, and his son went to see it like dressed in a Spider-Man outfit with his Black Panther plushie and everything. And he said he just turned to him real quiet at the end when the credits started and whispered to him, "It's not real, is it?" And I think, you know, this is painful.
Yeah.
I it actually brings me to another major point, which is the entire idea of doing it as a cliffhanger and waiting a year. I think for younger viewers, it's potentially traumatizing. And I also question the entire strategy of waiting a year. Basically, to me, and then I'll stop rambling. Basically, to me, I find that the stakes are almost meaningless. One, because we already know most of these characters have sequels planned.
Yeah.
But second, I feel that the longer it takes to get to the inevitable undo button, the more it feels useless to bother pretending. Like, if this were like part two was coming out in a couple months or even 6 months, like Back to the Future 2 and 3, mm-hmm. It's like you'd watch and go, well, we know this is the middle. And now they're expecting you to wait a whole year, and I just feel by the time we get to, oh, but it's all okay, everybody's back, it just makes it feel more perfunctory. But what do you think about all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. You know, I think for one thing, you and I, obviously, we approach this from a different perspective than a lot of people who just kind of go to the movies and don't follow the ins and outs of the how the things are made or what the rumor mill and all that stuff. And also, we go into it with the knowledge of the comics and yeah, a lot of people might not know Spider-Man Homecoming 2 is dated already, or, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy 3 is coming in 2020, you know, so I think some people it might resonate more for them because they aren't quite as keen to quite as clear on the ins and outs of how these things are made. But I think you're right. I think there is the risk of it being kind of, you know, the resolution of it being sort of anticlimactic. I mean, the obvious kind of parallel is Han Solo in Empire, which is such an amazing moment when he, you know, he's frozen and the movie then ends with Han being spirited away by Boba Fett and you don't know what's going to happen. And the, you know, Harrison Ford wasn't signed on for a sequel back then. Not that we necessarily knew that at the time when we were 10 years old or whatever, but
we had no internet to go to either.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. But all you knew was it was this, holy cow, Han is gone. What's going to happen? And Lando's wearing his clothes for some reason, you know? And
well, I guess I'll put on this vest then.
Right. But then when you get to Return of the Jedi, and that was a 3-year wait.
I know.
And it, you know, I really think I mean, it's so hard now to remember what was going through my mind back then, but
yeah.
I want to say that rescuing Han was kind of a letdown, and part of that might be even Harrison Ford's performance in that particular movie. He was clearly doesn't want to be in that movie, and he didn't, I think maybe didn't really, I mean, he agreed to do it, and I think he wanted to kill Han off in Return of the Jedi, but like, he, you just can tell his heart's not in the role anymore.
Could you tell Luke? Is that who you could tell? That whole, that whole scene just made me just so uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah, forget it. Yeah, so, so I don't know
if I had to be honest, I have to say I agree with you 100%. I remember feeling that as a kid, too.
Yeah, you know, so I don't know if that's part, you know, in that particular case, part of it is it's Harrison not being, you know, into the project anymore. But at the same time, I don't know if maybe just the nature of a cliffhanger like this, you're inevitably setting up some certain level of disappointment, too. I mean, I don't know. You know? So I've seen people speculate that maybe like in the case, like putting aside everyone who was turned to ash or dust or whatever, and the people who died from, you know, somewhat more conventional means, like Gamora, for example, I've seen some speculation that maybe she would stay dead and that that story will continue into Guardians 3, for example, which I'm not sure I buy into that or not, but, you know,
go ahead.
Yeah, but if that's the case, then it's like, well, then maybe there would be a more natural progression to how that story plays out, and it won't all just be another snap of the finger where everyone suddenly comes back to life in Avengers 4. But yeah, I think it is one of the dangers of what they did here, is how they resolve it without it feeling cheap.
I gotta go back to a few things you said, because it's funny that you brought up Empire, and obviously, again, we're in sync with so much similar pop culture experiences, and like you said, steeped in a lot of this stuff. And after seeing the movie, my wife Natalie and I were having this whole conversation, and she's a lot less invested in this from the past, so she can see it with a far more objective eye and point out a lot of things, which are some of the things I had noted to talk about that were very interesting to me, to like pick at some of the bits and pieces of this. But one of the things that actually came up was, I was thinking back to when I was a kid, and the only thing I could think of that comes close was Han and Empire.
Yeah.
And yet, I don't remember ever feeling that it was nearly as, it certainly wasn't as apocalyptic as this. Yeah. And if I were a kid now watching these characters in that same context, and if it was, well, I mean, now, of course, it'd still be the internet. I'd probably be the one likely to still hop online and try to find out stuff. But it just seems so overwhelming. And like you were mentioning about death's permanent and impermanent, I think it's pretty clear that everybody that dusted will be back. I mean, first of all, we know most of them are already all involved in future projects, and they're not lying about any of that. There's too much money involved.
Yeah.
But the ones, Loki, I wouldn't be surprised if they just basically try to let that stay the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, I feel that he may have gotten one of the most perfect 10-year arcs of any of them.
Yeah.
Because I love the fact that the incident that really drove the initial sort of expansion of the MCU was him collaborating with Thanos to invade Earth.
Yeah, it's true.
And now he finally pays for that mistake directly with Thanos, which seems to just be a perfect bookend. And I also love the fact that, similar to like the Doctor and the Master or similar other characters, I like the fact that in his final moments, his death is precipitated by his choice to save Thor.
Right.
That he loves him too much.
Yep.
And I think that's, you know, as much as I'd miss him, it's like, all right, but he's gotten quite a few movies, and, you know, maybe it's time to let him sit for a while, even if they did bring him back down the road. Just let it stick.
Absolutely.
And then as far as the others, Gamora is interesting, because James Gunn had been on the record, I think, as saying that Guardians 3 was Gamora heavy. But now I'm starting to wonder if he wasn't lying, but what he was implying was it's going to deal with grief and maybe do more flashbacks to include her. And then there's Vision, which I liked Paul Bettany a lot, but I honestly can't feel much of anything about that. Yeah. I think the character wound up suffering from, and actually the whole Vision and Scarlet Witch thing, is I always loved their relationship in the comics. But I feel that in the movies, by the time we get to this film, we're supposed to believe they're having this amazing whirlwind romance simply because we're told they are.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, really, what they're introduced in Age of Ultron, we see them like making food in Civil War as if they're already, you know, like a loving couple and like at a dating kind. And now in this one, it's like they're, you know, soulmates that are destined to always be together. And it's just, there wasn't much time to really care about them.
Yeah, they've definitely suffered from the sort of not having their own films. Develop them there, and you have the ones like you have the guys like War Machine and Falcon who feel very second or third tier, and it's kind of like, well, you know what, those guys, that's fine. But then when you get to like, and maybe this is just a personal opinion, I don't know, but then when you get to someone like Vision or Scarlet Witch, as a comics fan, it feels like they should be getting more to do. And they just don't, or they haven't in these movies. So, I wanted to just get back to also the idea of, because I meant to mention this and then it slipped my mind, but the idea of Avengers 4 kind of being, possibly being a letdown because everyone is resurrected. I suppose the way around that, which maybe is kind of obvious, but is that you wind up killing the people who survived this one are the ones who die in that one for good.
I really feel like that's probably where we're heading. Don't you think? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're all the ones that are the long-term contracts too.
Right.
To have keep relying on the real world, but I mean, like we know that they're done. So
yeah, exactly. Chris Evans he's done. He wants out. Downey Jr. I wouldn't be surprised if Downey Jr. would want to do it for the rest of his life, but I think he's probably so expensive. So you got to figure a couple of those guys probably don't make it out.
Here's the thing. I'm convinced Stark's going to die and that he's going to be the one to make the sacrifice that will also serve as another bookend to the original Avengers.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like, well, first of all, one of the main outs that I've seen plenty of people already pick apart pretty easily is that Doctor Strange saw 14 million possibilities and only one where they win. That just automatically means everything he did at the end there had to be to facilitate the one where we win.
Yep.
And that means handing over the time stone and making sure Tony doesn't die. So I'm thinking it's because Tony's got to be there at some point later to do the thing he's got to do.
Yep.
But I don't know who said this where I saw it, but now I love this idea and will be very disappointed if they don't do it, which is Tony Stark dies. Shuri builds a new Iron Man armor and becomes the Ironheart character from the comics and becomes the new Iron character, and Tony Stark's voice becomes the AI in the suit.
Yeah, I've heard variations of that as well. I like that. I like the idea of keeping Downey Jr. around in that capacity, and I'm sure Marvel would like that too, because you're just talking about some, you know, as less of a fee for him because it's mainly voiceover, right? A couple of maybe a couple of green screen shots for a hologram or something.
Yeah.
You know what I don't like about the idea of Shuri becoming an Iron Woman or whatever the character was? The character called Iron Heart.
Well, they called her Iron Heart for a while. I think they've actually now changed it so she's just in the current Iron Man, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
But it feels a little easy because the character, and you know, I'm not up on the current runs of the comics. I'm more of an old school guy.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'll pick something up here or there, and I try to stay, you know, in the know of what's going on, but I'm not going to New Comics Day every week, you know? And, but the character in the comics who replaced Tony Stark was Riri Williams, I guess. And
yes.
So it feels a little bit of like, oh, well, it's a African-American girl. We can just shove this African girl in there instead. And that's why I don't like that. It's like, oh, so the black girl becomes Iron Man now.
Yeah. And,
it's like,
and they're not interchangeable as people.
Yeah, they're two separate characters who happen to have the same color skin. So that's the thing about that. But the idea of him somehow becoming an AI is, that's cool. And
it seems like destiny, you know, I agree with the character thing because I've seen people on like both sides of the argument debating whether or not they like the idea of like conflating the two characters or like you said, it feeling like it's too convenient and dismissive of, you know, another character that could be a well-rounded character too. So that's hard to say, but the Stark part of it just feels like a perfect way.
It does.
You know,
it does. Yeah. Have you heard the theory about that Steve Rogers will, and this is, again, I think this is just a fan theory, but that Steve Rogers won't die, but that he'll somehow get tossed back into the past and, like, wind up living out his days with Peggy Carter somehow.
I have not heard that, but that sounds pretty sweet.
That could be cool. I mean, yeah. I guess it creates a splinter timeline because we know Peggy did. That's not the Peggy we know, but still.
True,
but
unlike what Marvel tried to say originally, it's definitely not all connected. So
right, exactly.
They don't give a damn what the TV shows do.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, they could do that.
And then you still leave. You know, you leave. You still have Cap if you want him. You can bring, you know, say 5 years from now, they decide to bring Steve Rogers back for like a one movie deal, mm-hmm. or like he shows up in Avengers 5 or something, you know, whatever, you know? So, I mean, of course, ultimately anyone dead or not can come back. I mean, this is comic books, right? So, sometimes the fan theories, you have to wonder if the guys writing these movies ever pull from any of these fan theories, because there's some great ideas floating around out there.
I know, you can sort of just crowdsource the thinking, and you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing is, and here's another thing, it's like, this is a really deep spoiler because you have to have really cared enough to look at these things, but I certainly have, I'm sure you have too. But one of the things I'm actually looking forward to about the next one is Easy Reset Switch, even though that's something that ultimately that whole movie is going to have to be about. I like the clues dropped from Strange. There's Captain Marvel, you know, having her be involved somehow. It made me think also about what we're likely to see structurally from now until then. Like, since Ant-Man and the Wasp and Captain Marvel are next, it became clear. And then we started hearing, or at least I started hearing things that confirmed it, so I felt really smart. Where I thought, oh, so what's going to happen in Ant-Man and the Wasp is they're going to look for the original Wasp. That'll take them into the quantum realm long enough that they'll basically miss everything contemporary with Infinity War and step back out at the end of the movie, and it'll be like, what the hell's going on here? And obviously it sounds like that is what they're doing.
Seems like it.
And then Captain Marvel is a 1990s film. And then maybe in a parallel with the first Captain America, maybe they'll bring her up to the present for a post-credits or an end bit that will then link to the Infinity War ending, because that's going to be our last time sitting in a theater until Infinity War 2 or whatever it's called comes out.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the... there's no Marvel release this fall, actually.
It doesn't sound like it.
Yeah, no, there's not. Which
it sounds
is a
like
little...
Ant-Man and the Wasp is next.
Yeah, Ant-Man and the Wasp, and then Captain Marvel in March.
Yeah.
And then Avengers in May, Avengers 4 in May. So
yeah.
So I think you're right. I wonder, the Captain Marvel thing being set in the 90s, I wonder, I don't think they'll do this, but I worry a little bit that it could feel a little bit too much like Captain America, Man Out of Time.
I'm wondering if, I mean, it does feel like there's the potential for a little bit of paralleling there, and whether or not that's good, we'll only be able to tell when we see it. But yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, for sure. Arnold, do you think that the division of who got, you know, blinked out of existence, I guess, if that's what happened, and who didn't, comes down to Marvel sort of setting up the idea of the new Avengers as well?
I think so. I mean, I, like you were just saying, I think part of the whole thing is that it's sort of almost painfully convenient that all of the veterans were the ones that were left.
Yeah.
You know, so they will be the ones to make the grand sacrifice and fight to the end, and probably more than one of them dying or at least, you know, retiring semi-gracefully in order to, you know, hand it off.
Yeah.
But one way or the other, I think so, that's because, what's happening.
Yeah. And there's also this notion out there of that perhaps they didn't die, but they were the 50% of folks who disappeared were sent to the soul world inside the soul gem, right? And if that is the case, and we're going to actually see what's going on in there, you would then have all these newer heroes. I mean, I guess they're the second generation of heroes having to work together and as sort of proto Avengers, right? You would have, Black Panther, who would be the leader, Black Panther or Doctor Strange. But you have
those. I feel like Black Panther would be the leader from a more strategic point of view. Strange is more like the guy that stands on the side and like advises based on his expertise, but he's not like a strategic leader.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I could be wrong, but yeah.
So if that is what is going on, then you have Black Panther as leader, Doctor Strange, Spider-Man, Winter Soldier, I guess, is part of that group.
Scarlet Witch. Yeah.
The Guardians, I kind of think of them just still being the Guardians. I don't think they're going to join the Avengers, technically speaking, right?
Not really.
And then I guess maybe, I think Falcon as well went over, right? So yeah, I mean, that's interesting, though. And then, of course, obviously Captain Marvel has to join once she gets here.
Another possibility for a leader at that point also.
That's true, actually.
Yeah, depending on how she's played.
It was never that clearly defined who the leader of the original Avengers was in the MCU.
Not really, actually. Like I remember growing up with the comics and they always made damn sure we knew there was like a chairman.
You know,
and like the Wasp ran it forever and she was, you know, usually either her or Cap was like the chairman for the... So yeah, they never really did that.
It was like, it was sort of Cap, but then like Tony was, you know, it's also Robert Downey Jr. And when he's in the room, you know, he's Robert Downey Jr. So,
so you kind of got to defer to him a little bit. Yeah, I'll tell you, one of the things, and getting back to what I was saying about some of the things about the follow-up is there's aspects of it that feel, like you were pointing out, dangerously close to feeling disappointing because of the setup that you're left with at the end.
Yeah.
But one of the things that encourages me a little bit is I had missed some of the coverage of the shooting of the movies back to back when it was all happening. And I was looking up stuff again recently and seeing like all the stuff that had been tweeted like back around like January when they were like really deep, I guess, into what they were at the time were calling like Avengers 4, you know, right. Shooting all that. And the thing that really made me excited is, and I mentioned this a bit earlier in another context, is one of my favorite film-going memories as a fan of anything in the more recent past was when they did Back to the Future 2 and 3 and gave us that six-month break, and then we rolled into the final part.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking Back to the Future 2 and the beauty of how that wove into the original film. And then I look back at all the stuff from Avengers 4 and see that they were apparently shooting what looked like Battle of New York stuff with Cap there in his original outfit and his hair and no beard from then, but Tony with blonde hair and a shield outfit and Ant-Man there. Yeah. And all of them wearing some kind of hand thing. So it looks like there's some kind of either time travel or Tony's Civil War holodeck kind of stuff going on.
Right, yeah, and I've heard that people obviously have speculated that it's time travel, but then they've also speculated that it's, that holodeck thing. There was also images of Thor in his sort of, I guess, Avengers era, Avengers 1 look, right, with the long hair and everything, but not with the bleached eyebrows from the first Thor movie, which was so weird. But I don't know. And then of course, people are also like, oh, Marvel's purposely letting those photos leak just to throw everyone off the trail. So it's like...
right. Although it did, you know, we all went into this movie and it didn't resolve anything for us about where the hell Hawkeye was all this time.
That's true. Yeah.
We just got that stupid house arrest line for him and Ant-Man.
Yeah. And I've expected Cap to die for two movies now because I figured he was the goner at the end of Civil War, like in the comics. And then I thought this one, Thanos was going to take him out. So I don't know. So I think predicting at a certain point, they're pretty good at not letting us figure out what their plan is. Speaking of Ant-Man though, I love that line that Bruce Banner has about, oh, there's an Ant-Man and a Spider-Man now.
Yes. I think Ruffalo is the, you know, everybody always says who the MVP is. There were a lot of great things from almost everybody. A lot of great lines. And, you know, I think a perfect balance of the usual humor with some really dark, tragic stuff. But I think Ruffalo may have been, similar to Ragnarok, the real highlight for me most of the time. Even if, as many people pointed out, his entire role in this movie was one big, long erectile dysfunction metaphor. But still.
Yeah. You know.
And it's interesting, too, by the way, going back to Back to the Future for a minute, and also going back to the thing about how traumatizing this is for kids, is that one thing Natalie brought up. She always seems to find a way to make like the ending of something better, or rather, if she had been given the chance to do it, she could make it better. And she suggested that given the fact that they shot this stuff back to back, it's kind of a bit grating and frustrating. She doesn't like the cliffhanger aspect and the serialization of it to this extent anyway. So she's frustrated by that. But she was saying that it would have been so much better and also potentially better for kids. And all of us who already know where this has got to go in some respect anyway, we know this isn't over. Yeah. If, like at the end of Back to the Future 2, they had done Nick Fury and Maria as the mid-credit thing, which they didn't do at all, and then for the end credits, do like a quick 30-second trailer for the next one.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me how odd it is, now that I think back on it, that they didn't do any kind of trailer for the next one, which seems like they should have.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And do you recall there was a, they did, they have, there is a history of that, right? Because they did.
Yes, they did it for the Avengers.
Yeah, I think it was the end of Captain America, the first Avenger, right?
That's right.
Instead of a final Easter egg, it was a final, you know, end credit scene. It was like a 30-second trailer for Avengers. Yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah that would have made a lot of sense. Yeah,
it feels a bit odd now. Another thing she brought up that I wanted to touch on was that she said, in some respects, and this I can't disagree with either, that when you do a story like this, the first part is often plagued with problems. And I think we've already talked about how we still feel this did such a phenomenal job. But it's plagued with problems in that while the part two has the potential to be disappointing, as we were saying earlier, part one of this kind of story often has the problem of being the movie that just has to set up all the pieces on the board.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's like, you know, a classic example is like them splitting up Deathly Hallows from Harry Potter into two films and everybody feeling like the first one is just kind of a runaround until you get to this doesn't feel like that, in that there's so many entertaining bits and pieces of dialogue and set pieces and things like that. But in a certain respect, one of the things she was saying was really the entire 2.5 hours of this one movie was just to take all of the heroes that you've loved. This is how she put it. Here's all the heroes that you've loved for 10 years. Here's all of them being defeated. The whole point of this movie was to show you that your heroes could be defeated. You're welcome. and her point was that in some respects, you could cut this down quite a bit and accomplish that same theme, like that same thematic point.
Yeah.
And then provide a resolution.
Yeah.
And I can't disagree. It's true that that's the case.
Yeah, well, part of it becomes feeling that you have to service each of the many characters from the respective franchises too, right? But
mm-hmm.
but really, by and large, hitting on that same idea with each of them, right? So
and the other thing too is I can't think, maybe I'm just blanking right now. The other thing too, and I don't have a problem with this necessarily because it's the way this movie functions. Like we were just saying, it's different. The standalone films can have depth and emotional resonance and above all character development in a way that the collective films like this may not have time for or may not bother with. I can't think of any significant character development for any character in the entire range that we got in this film. I don't think any character goes through any major development at all. They are who they are and they play their part in this crisis and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty, if there is any, it's fairly, well, I guess Thanos and Gamora maybe are the exception to some degree.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is so interesting that the bad guy and one of the Guardians are the kind of the most important characters in.
It's really Thanos' movie. He's the one with the character arc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even to the point where at the very end, I don't know if you caught this, but the final thing we see is in the credits, I think it's after the Nick Fury scene,
yes,
is Thanos will return.
Thanos will return. Yeah.
Or Thanos, is it just Thanos will return?
It just says Thanos will return. Yeah.
It's like, well, he won, so he's the one who gets to say that, right?
You know? Yeah. I heard somebody in our theater actually yell out and said, no, we don't need Thanos to return.
But I think you're right. And I think some characters were underserved more than others, like Cap. Really,
Cap was really underserved.
Yeah, disappointingly so. Stark has there is not much there, but Stark has this thing about wanting to be a dad, and by the end of the movie, his surrogate child figure dies in his arms.
Yeah.
So there's that. Banner's thing is this conflict with the Hulk being afraid, I guess. That strikes me as the most incomplete. Like, if anyone has a problem with this movie being a cliffhanger, mm-hmm. I feel like Banner's story is an example of why that's a problem. Because, like, the bigger story of the MCU is always ongoing. So if we accept that, then to a certain degree, you have to say, okay, we knew this was going to be a cliffhanger going in, chances are. But, like, the character threads, you would hope that there is a little bit of, an arc. And the Banner, we get, like, some guys like Cap, we don't even get any setup. There's just nothing there character-wise, right? Yeah. It's just Cap. Banner, we get the setup of this idea of the Hulk, and we don't see any, like, resolution to it. Thor has his thing about his search for the weapon, which, you know, on paper, I guess, is a point A to point B kind of character thing, even though it totally, like, undoes his character arc from the Thor Ragnarok.
Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. So here are a couple things about Thor's part particularly. One of them's a complaint of mine, and one is something else that Natalie pointed out. I hate sequels that undo the victory of a previous film.
Yeah, and a recent film, too.
Yeah, right? And I understand that that has to happen sometimes when a story continues, but life is like that. You know, but we don't need movies to always be like life. And, like, to me, one of the great examples is Alien 3 coming along and murdering nearly everybody. You know, that was the whole point of her victory at the end of Aliens. And now they're gone. Right. And that kind of thing. And then in this, right. Thor Ragnarok is such a delightful, joyous film. And then at the beginning of this, all of that victory is erased. All of the Asgardians are murdered. And if we hold to what we think might be the rule, those are deaths that take place outside the realm of what might be able to be undone. So it's pretty devastating for what happened there. The other thing, and I think it was Natalie that brought this up, is that we got a lot of material with Thor in this movie that could probably have been cut. I do think that much of the forging of Stormbreaker wasn't necessary. It was pretty. Yeah. Yep. I think Peter Dinklage got one of my favorite lines in the entire movie where, you know, he said something like, you know, this could kill you. And Thor said, only if I die. And he said, yes, that's what killing you means. I like that. Yeah. But it's such a long sequence where we could have gotten like a glimpse of it. And then the other thing that she pointed out, which is kind of true, is she said one of the only conversations in the film that's very focused on depth of character is this moment we get where Thor and Rocket kind of talk for a while.
Yeah.
And it accomplishes nothing in a certain respect because, as she pointed out, we already know Rocket isn't really an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, we already know that he's got a heart. And we also already know that Thor has dealt with loss.
Yeah.
Profound loss. And they just kind of double down on both of those things. And it's nice, and I like the way they performed it, and it was fun, but I don't really think it was necessary. And all I can think now as we're talking is those precious minutes devoted to character development that really had already been accomplished, maybe they could have given that to Cap for something, or, you know, well, whatever.
I know what you mean about that scene. I love that exchange between the two of them.
Yeah.
I would rather see the Starforge stuff go, and keep that scene between, Rocket and Thor. I think part of that scene, which actually didn't actually play out as successfully as I would have liked it to have, was the idea of Rocket becoming a leader, sort of, you know, he keeps saying he's the captain now and he goes to give Thor a pep talk, but then it kind of ends with him making a joke about how he still has a lot to lose or something like that. And so I feel like they didn't quite see it through as well as they could have. But I definitely hear where she's coming from as well on that. And the Starforge stuff also, though, is like, I understand these are comic book movies, but like the science of that stuff is like, wait, how close, like it is a star, right? Like,
right.
How far away is it from like,
don't try to think of it too hard. And he's a god sort of, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. That's so, that too.
I mean, I also had like a list of things after like right after I'd seen it and was still lingering, but at this point I think I'm willing to let go of. One little whole chunk of things I wanted to talk about originally was all the character choices that I felt were made in the movie that were so frustrating, most of which were people making what I initially saw as horrendous mistakes to the detriment of a universe. One being everyone involved with the Wakanda story deciding it makes more sense to have Shuri try to save the Vision rather than just crush his skull immediately.
Yeah.
and stop that. I mean, the moment any one of those stones is out of the equation, Thanos is defeated forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And instead it's like, yeah, but can we, well, maybe we can try to, it's like, no, murder him. And then the thing is, Vision himself. Although I blame him partly, too, because he could have just reached up to his own head and, you know, ripped the stone
out.
That's
true. Yeah, that's true.
But he doesn't. And then the other two things were Strange constantly saying how important it is to protect the Time Stone, which he's then going to just hand away anyway when he could have done something in all of his magic bag of tricks to destroy it and solve it there.
Yeah.
And then the third and final thing is Star-Lord being a complete and total asshole at the worst possible moment.
Yeah.
And picking a fight with Thanos when they nearly have the glove off. Now, yeah. All these things are emotional choices. And I've seen people, including some folks from IGN, arguing that, like, in a way it almost feels appropriate that these characters, in moments of this intense, tension and challenge, made poor choices, but they were choices that were human and emotional rather than logical. But the other thing that also I think about is, well, it's kind of convenient and a little pat for storytelling in the script, but since we know this is probably the one way, that also means all those choices had to happen.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's an easy way to forgive the whole movie, but
yeah,
but there's that.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's true. I guess one of the themes of the movie is me. We're only human. I don't know. Lot of mistakes are made. That is definitely true.
yeah. And Thanos is rendered as such, like we talked about him having one of the only solid character arcs. He is given some of the most depth of feeling and personality of almost any other villain they've ever had. Which is pretty satisfying considering, like you were saying almost right at the beginning, how much of a joke he'd almost become at this point.
Yeah, it's true.
As our post-credits purple guy.
Yeah.
And then he shows up and it's like, this is an interesting guy with an argument that's not entirely wrong.
Yeah. And he's a CGI creature. You know, he doesn't even look, I mean, he's fairly ridiculous looking if you think about it, right?
Yeah, and yet they sell it.
And they sell it, yeah.
Yeah.
They pull it off and they bring it all together with, you know, the idea. It had been established in Guardians that Gamora was his stepdaughter and all, or his adopted daughter, rather.
Mm-hmm.
They really come back to that in such a big way, to the detriment of guys like Cap, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's like, well, if you want more Cap, you're going to have to wait for some other Cap-specific film.
Yeah.
He really is just kind of playing the role of a soldier in this.
Yeah, or put on your Blu-rays, actually, because he won't be back after four.
That's so. Right. Catch up again on your Red Skull history. So that was one of the nice... by the way, that's another thing. Extra kudos to Russ Marquand of The Walking Dead for...
Yeah.
I mean, granted, the makeup makes it somewhat easier to be able to replicate something, but he did a damn good job doing the voice, too.
Yeah, he really did. Yeah, and... I wasn't able to catch his name in the closing credits either. So I really was like, I know Hugo Weaving didn't come back. There's no mm-hmm. way, because he was so vocal about not wanting to return to it. And I was like, how did they pull it off? You know? And then when I realized who it was, I was like, really? That guy, I guess he's known for doing impressions and things.
He's been known for several years, like in the Walking Dead and fan community. He does a lot of stuff on like YouTube and like on the set too. He does a lot of impressions of famous people.
Okay.
So it's one of his things.
And
it's just neat that, you know, he also has a very similar, you know, facial structure to Weaving, at least enough to be able to build the thing on. And it was fun seeing him tweeting stuff from like the, I liked the pictures he was tweeting from the opening, like the red carpet, I guess was the LA one or whatever. And and he's wearing like an all Scarlet Red suit and saying, you know, thrilled to finally be part of the Marvel Universe. And people are tweeting at Ross, who are you in this? And he's like, well, you'll see.
The Scarlet Spider.
There's a Scarlet Spider now, too.
We were actually, I was debating with a couple of the folks from IGN about the Red Skull in this, because some people were saying, oh, he's not human anymore. He was somehow changed in some way. Did you take that for?
Here's what I assume, because I also saw people like having problems or issues with this. I think, like Loki, it's interesting, actually, now that I think of it, I could sort of formulate an article about this, that the people that get the most character development in Infinity War are all the villains, past and present, and not the heroes.
Yeah.
Thanos has an amazing arc within the film. Loki finally gets what I feel is a very satisfying and appropriate, if sad, bookend to all the mistakes he made at the beginning of the series.
Yep.
And the third one is the Red Skull, who spent all his time seeking power, was sucked up into the sky by the Tesseract, one of the stones, which even back then we saw that at the end, and like the beam goes up into space. So it was like, well, clearly he's being transported somewhere. And then turns up as the keeper of the Soul Stone. I thought it was a beautiful finale for him. I saw one person also saying, well, I guess they wouldn't put him in if he isn't going to come back again. And I was like, why would you think that? This is probably the last time we'll ever see him.
Right.
And the point is, I think this is a very appropriate thing that basically shows that someone who, let's face it, for all intents and purposes, a Nazi, and you know, no one that we should be sparing any sympathy for, has paid the ultimate price for the hubris. And basically, this is his hell.
Yep.
Is that he is, whether he's not a living being anymore, probably, he's a spirit. And he has now been cursed that, you know, by the scientific means of the Marvel Universe, but cursed to be the custodian of that stone, because that's the price he's paying for having, you know, fooled with the other one. And that makes perfect sense to me. I like that idea. It felt very biblical, sort of Dante-like, you know, I liked it. And I know that some people also were kind of thrown because they thought for a moment that we were finally getting like the personification of death and a nod to Thanos' comic origins. But I really thought the use of the Red Skull there was a clever and also satisfying moment.
Yeah. And that had to be, they were purposely teasing the comics fans with that silhouette image of the cloak.
I think so,
right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're finally getting Mistress Death?
yeah, I think so.
No, surprise.
Yeah, and he also gets to have a great moment or two, too. Like, he gets the moment where he's like, you know, he's not, the tears aren't for him.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's nice. I like the idea that the Red Skull is like transcended into being this sort of tortured, cursed soul, which is as it should be.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah.
So, yeah. Any other thoughts or things that that you've been mulling over since seeing it that you haven't had a chance to talk about or that you've been thinking about?
I mean, there's, you know, so many little bits and pieces of, you know, that I keep thinking about. I mean, I think I knew the movie was going to work for me when they cut to the Guardians for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
They cut to space.
Rubber
Band Man is on, and it says, and then it's, I think on screen text comes on and just says space or something
space.
Like that.
Yeah.
And it was like, it's totally, all of a sudden it was like, oh, now we're in a Guardians movie, but this actually is totally fine. Like, it totally, the transition totally worked. And, you know, I mean, the Guardians movies are so very different than the Avengers movies, right? And at that moment, I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is really all coming together, you know? So, they do. They really do. And I just, there's so many little things here and there that I just really enjoyed about it. And like you, also lots of little complaints and things as well. I also really just love this Spider-Man. I love the Tom Holland Spider-Man.
He's superb.
Yeah,
I felt that early on that we find, like, even in the brief appearance in Civil War, it felt like I was finally seeing Spider-Man. I mean, I like Tobey Maguire. I thought Andrew Garfield did the best with what he was given, but that was a pretty tortured era. And this kid is just this is Spider-Man.
Yeah, it's great.
This is what I always thought he should be.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I love the... As cool as the seeing the Iron Spider suit is and all, like... I don't know that, like, what... Does he even need spider powers anymore? You know, if he...
I like the idea that that's something that comes into play because he needs something extra amped up for being in space.
I guess so, yeah.
I would say just, yeah, get rid of that damn thing as soon as he's back on Earth again. Cause yeah. Because you're right. It suggests an access to technology and power that on one level it makes perfect sense why he would have access to it, but on another... It just takes all of the fun out of everything for him to have that.
So why doesn't Tony, like, give Hawkeye an iron Hawkeye right. suit? You know? Like,
I mean, he's the one who really needs it. Iron suits.
Yeah. Iron Thunder God, you know?
Yeah. That's the other thing, too, is there are moments, everything from, I think, one of my favorite comedic moments is Drax saying how he's, you know, mastered the art of being invisible, which we loved. He's amazing, too. That I never would have thought he's so incredibly funny every time.
He really is. Out.
But yeah. It was like two of those really massively cheering moments were when the Avengers theme kicked in, when Cap and Black Widow and Falcon come in to save Vision and Scarlet Witch.
Yeah. And I think it's actually like... the Cap. I think that's actually the Cap theme.
Is it the Cap theme at that
moment? Am I wrong about that?
I don't know. I don't remember enough now to be able to tell. Okay. Somebody out there listening right now already knows that I'm wrong. So it's fine.
Or I'm wrong.
And when Thor shows up at the end. In Wakanda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So great. Fist pumping awesome. Moments. Yeah. And it's like, oh, okay, all the Starforge stuff was worth it, it turns out.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's the kind of thing, this a movie like this, we couldn't have dreamed of this when we were kids. Or we dreamed of it, but never thought it would happen. You know?
I think that's ultimately where I stand, is that I've been enjoying this series so much. I definitely would put this sort of in the middle. Like, if I were doing the thing that inevitably we always seem to do on websites and everything of ranking the whole list of movies, I would play the game, and I probably will do it now that I'm thinking of it, and see, like, how I rank everything. I'm pretty sure this would fall sort of in the middle. I mean, it's certainly just not nearly as satisfying a story as any one of the standalones, because you're not getting a chance to really, you know, delve into the character of any one particular person.
Yep.
And that's just part of it. But it was an amazing chapter in an ongoing saga. And to see the entire Marvel Universe in play is like, I just can't believe it. I just can't believe it's happening.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I actually did have to, for work, we were asked to rank the Marvel movies. You know, I mean, that's such a tough task in and of itself, but in attempting to do it, I think this Infinity War wound up somewhere like, I don't know, around like number 8 for me or something like that. So,
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like there's a lot of strong stuff above it, you know, so.
Yeah, and you're cutting that really finer and finer when you're putting things on the list. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
But I know that in the course of about an hour or so of talking, we were never going to... resolve issues of whether, you know, this is the right way to tell the story or not. I know that, like, you know, there's a ton of hot takes and debates going on. A lot of people in the more mainstream media being raked over the coals for being so dismissive of things, but that's the way it is. And then there are a lot of us who are told, well, we're seeing everything through Marvel colored glasses. So it's a little tough, but you know,
and I'm, you know, I look at the New York Times and I see A.O. Scott give, you know, Mr. Highfalutin New York Times movie critic, give it a not great review. And, you know, it disappoints me. I want to see movies like this, recognized by mainstream outlets. And oftentimes genre movies are recognized. So it disappoints me. But at the same time, it's like, well, these people are entitled to their opinions as well. So
absolutely
nothing bothers me more than the fanboys who get pissed off about, you know, a critic not liking something that they like. But that's not how this works.
And getting combative about it, when ultimately one of the bigger things here that's important to take away is what we were already saying, which is this is quite a gift to be in a time where these movies exist. They are produced and supported by probably what is now the largest content maker on the planet with Disney. Yep. And say what you will about that, and there's plenty of negativity to explore about that as well, but when you're you know, looking at it through your Marvel colored glasses, I can't imagine having a better company supporting it, because you know they're going to do everything they can to keep making these things and try to make them as entertaining as possible. And I don't believe the argument that having 4 or 6 or 8 of these at a time is in any way dampening the vast scope of pop culture in general to do it. I saw somebody also mention how in the 50s, for instance, at a given time, there were like 150 Westerns that were being made.
Yeah.
And it's like the idea that the superhero genre is swamping all creativity is simply ridiculous.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you know what? In this day and age, especially where your media choices are like practically unlimited, like, you know, if you don't want to go see Infinity War, then get a subscription to Filmstruck, you know, and watch some, you know, whatever. Like, now I love Infinity War and I love Filmstruck. That's me.
But exactly.
Like, if you're not into it, then that's your thing. But what, you know, like, there's
so
many choices.
I do a lot of stuff for continuing education programs at several local universities, and I just wrapped up an Ilya Kazan series we were looking at, like On the Waterfront and A Face in the Crowd, and I love that.
Yeah.
I love this. I love horror movies. There's room for everything.
Yep.
There are people out there, like the people writing some of these hot takes, who are saying, like, you know, the superhero genre is too much, and I think would gladly slip on a glove, snap their fingers, and erase half of the superhero movies in existence. But that's not going to happen.
Hopefully, mostly the Fantastic Four movies.
I think so. Yeah, maybe Justice League and a couple others. It's sad, really. I think one of the things that I actually find heartbreaking the most, and Natalie actually comes from sort of a DC family, which it's so weird how that really works. There
yeah.
are families that are one or the other.
Yeah.
And it's kind of heartbreaking that DC fans, I mean, some are enjoying, I guess, what they're getting. But it just seems like they're not getting their universe treated with nearly the same creative zeal as we're getting with the Marvel films.
Yeah.
And those characters deserve it.
They really do.
And it's a shame.
It is. They need a Kevin Feige over there who knows how to make movies, but also gets the comics side of things. And they've not been able to find someone like that yet. So I really think that's a big part of the problem. And of course, now they're having to play catch up as well. There's this perception that they've screwed everything up, which doesn't help either. So they'll get it sooner or later, I think. They're not going to give up. So
let's end on a happier note then. And first I'll say that I'm so glad you were able to do this on short notice and basically indulge us both in the chance to sit and talk about this for a bit.
Yeah.
But
thank you.
As Infinity War is now in the books and obviously not for very long, and it'll still probably have quite a healthy run. It's already made box office history. It's like, what was it, the biggest all-time opening ever? What do you think about the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe looking ahead the next 10 years? Not some of the specifics plot-wise we were talking about, but more in sort of the vast scope of things. Do you see this? I also saw a report that said they definitely have things planned at least through 2025.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we just got that news this week. Well, you know, it's crazy. 10 years ago, this all started. And I remember interviewing the cast of Iron Man when it came out, and who could have known? I remember asking Downey Jr. about, oh, can Avengers happen? Because we had that tease at the end with Nick Fury, and he wouldn't even really, he didn't want to even think about it back then. Mm-hmm. So to think, to say, well, another 10 years, that sounds like such a long amount of time. And yet at the same time, it could go by so quickly. So I think the question is going to come down to continuing to find ways to do new and interesting things with the universe. And I don't know if that means somehow continuing to exploit other corners of it that are less superhero-y, like Guardians was such a big deal and so good because, you know, it kind of went in a totally different direction. I would love to see them maybe get into like the horror and monster side of Marvel.
Oh yeah, sure.
You know, maybe something like that. You know, it can't just continue to be superhero stuff, right? So I think that's going to be the key, is figuring out other ways to mine the Marvel universe. What do you
think?
And
I guess I agree with all that, and I also have just in the back of my mind is like an annoying little thing that I'm trying to ignore right now is it almost seems no matter how well this basic approach is working, there's also the inevitability that one day they might consider rebooting everything.
Right.
Like, you know, one day will they look and say, well, you know, it's the characters of Iron Man and Thor and Captain America and Black Widow and all these that work so well. But obviously with everyone so much older, we'll start again.
Yeah.
And this has been, there has never been an effort like this on this scale in cinema, in pop culture history. And I wonder how much longer it can go in this particular incarnation. I'd happily see it go another 10 years, but I'm sure that question will come up at some point too.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I mean, that's what the X-Men are facing right now, right? With, you know, recasting Wolverine, it seems like that's inevitable at some point or another. I don't know. I mean, one of the things about the comics that often bugged me was, not to drag this out too much longer, but it was you know, the fact that people never really changed or aged in any meaningful way. Right. Maybe, you know, maybe this is a chance to let the universe grow and age. And, you know, eventually, you know, let's say Tony Stark does survive. Eventually you have a, you know, 65-year-old Tony Stark who's more sort of back at Stark headquarters, kind of overseeing operations. And the younger generation are, you know, Peter Parker is now 30, you know, the 32-year-old, you know, who works for the Daily Bugle, and the true younger generation, you know, like the daughter of Peter or whatever. Maybe that's a way to do it as well.
I'd love to see that kind of approach.
Yeah. And then you're not because I think the thing about reboots is you inevitably are going to, you might have the trap of rehashing stories. Whether it's origins or character relationships or whatever. And I mean, I think that's why something like Amazing Spider-Man, the series with Andrew Garfield, didn't work so well. That's just one of many reasons. But it was like if, a lot of it felt like been there, done that, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Well,
hopefully
we can
keep podcasting about it, though.
Right? I would like to. Yeah, I mean, I just got this idea because it occurred to me that this is such a watershed moment.
Yeah.
And I thought you're the only person I would want to talk to about it. And and I figure, you know, it like a lot of things, this doesn't have to be any regular thing. I certainly am not like yourself, not somebody that keeps up with the current comics so much. So I'm mainly focused on the films, so maybe when Ant-Man and the Wasp rolls around, we'll chat again and just talk about the movies when they come up and see how it goes.
Yeah, I would love to make this a semi-regular thing. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do that then. And if any other ideas come to you, we'll see about that. But anyway, I hope everybody enjoyed our little conversation. It's been our first episode of the Marvel Cinematic Universe Review in quite a while. Thanks again, Scott Kalora, for joining me for this 1 hour celebration of 10 years.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to everybody again soon.